Action Watch, a blog that tracks the withdrawal of peer-reviewed scientific papers. Ivan has been a senior editor at Scientific American and Reuters Health. He teaches at New York University's Graduate School of Journalism, where he's also an assistant professor of medicine. He is currently editorial director of MedPage Today. Welcome to Digital Divide, Ivan.
Thanks for having me.
So you recently published an article in the New York Times about cracking down on scientific fraudsters. What do you mean by scientific fraud?
That's a good question. Adam Marcus, who's my co-founder at Retraction Watch, he and I published an op-ed in July, and it may help to sort of tell the story of the person we sort of centered on, this guy named Dongpyu Han, who was found to have committed scientific misconduct, scientific fraud, in Iowa. He was at Iowa State University at the time. What he did was actually fake results by spiking rabbit blood. He was working on an HIV vaccine or a possible HIV vaccine. He spiked that rabbit blood with human blood to make it look as if his HIV vaccine was working in rabbits. And I think that's the kind of thing everyone can very quickly understand is clearly fraud, and obviously it involved science, so this is scientific fraud. And the reason he's facing charges and the reason why we were writing about this in the New York Times is that he took federal money to do that. His lab took a total of about $19 million, some millions of which came after these results because they were so promising. And so when you commit fraud, when you do something wrong with federal money, you, we think, should be liable in the same way that you would be if it was, you know, a federal contract of some other kind.
Has this been going on for a long time, and we're just discovering it, or is the scale of misconduct a new development?
Fraud is a very small percentage of what's happening. And while the number of retractions is clearly on the rise, that number grew from 2001 to 2010, it grew 10 times, while the number of papers didn't grow anywhere near that number, that percentage. In fact, a lot of that may not be due to more fraud. It may be us just being better at picking it up.
Okay. And just briefly, what is peer review, and what does it mean to retract a paper?
So peer review is the system that, you know, it's been around for several hundred years, and the idea is if you're a scientist, you do some work in the lab or whatever it is that you do, you put together a paper, you submit it to a journal, and then a bunch of your peers, people who, you know something that you do and can kind of look at your paper critically, three or four of those people are asked to review the paper, usually anonymously, or at least anonymously to you, and critique it and say, yeah, this is worth publishing, but you should change this, or, you know, this really isn't worth publishing, or, great, publish it. And the idea is that it's just a system of checks and balances so that things don't just get published without anyone even thinking about them or looking at them. And a lot of that is supposed to pick up a lot of problems in papers. Now, whether you can pick up fraud or not is a bit of an open question, because if someone is really hell-bent on making up results the way Dietrich Stoppel, who's a psychology researcher in the Netherlands, did, he ended up having to retract 54 papers, which is obviously a lot. And what a retraction is basically the author, the editor, the publisher, the institution saying, you shouldn't trust these results anymore. There's something about this paper, either the results, the conclusion, or both, that they're not reliable.
And why doesn't peer review catch scientific fraud, at least in some instances?
Some of the things that people do to try and commit fraud are pretty, I hate calling them ingenious. That seems to be praising them. I'm not. But they are in that sort of way that criminals can be ingenious. And so, you know, people have figured out ways to do their own peer review. They've made up results that sort of look pretty good if you don't look at them too hard. And so if a peer reviewer is looking at things, there has to be some level of trust. And if you're not looking at the original data, you're just looking at the sort of pretty, narrative that someone has created in this paper or using figures, it can be fairly difficult to pick up what's going on. And sometimes that requires another layer of investigation that, you know, not every journal has time for.
Why does scientific fraud matter? Won't it all just come out in the wash, or does it impact the science journalism that the public sees and hears?
You know, sort of straightforward answers. A lot of it's paid for by tax dollars, and you want as little waste as possible when you do that. But more in a bigger picture, you know, some of these studies, people are being treated based on these studies, you know, and someone has actually looked at that and found that there were hundreds of thousands of people who were in clinical trials of drugs and surgeries and things like that, based on what turned out to be wrong results. And that is actually directly affecting people. But it's also, I think, even the bigger picture, the 30,000 feet here is, you know, scientists want to be trusted, and you can understand why, and they deserve a lot of trust. But they want to be trusted because they are transparent, and because they are honest. And when you hear about cases where people aren't being transparent, aren't being honest, and I don't mean the people committing the fraud, I actually mean the people who are tasked with trying to find it and get rid of it. When you hear about that stuff, you just think, you know, the cover-up is always worse than the crime. You know, we've learned that in politics. And, you know, the fact is, if you're transparent, if you say, you know what, we made some mistakes and here's some fraud, but we're doing everything we can to get rid of it and limit it, you know, the public will trust you much more than if you say, keep saying, well, you know, there's not a lot of fraud around, so don't worry about it. And then big cases come up the way they often do.
Is peer review evolving? We see not only Retraction Watch, but also PubPeer, a website which, in a sense, crowdsources peer review.
Yeah, so peer review is evolving, you know, the same way everything is. And again, you know, it's not like peer review's been with us since, you know, millions of years ago. It's a relatively new thing, so you'd expect it to change and evolve with time. PubPeer.com, which you mentioned, is really, we think, Adam and I think, this is a tremendously important site that has actually already led to a bunch of retractions and corrections, very important ones. And what they do is what we refer to as post-publication peer review. So what you and I have been talking about here is really traditional peer review, which is what happens before a paper is published. This is actually happening afterward, and people are pointing out, hey, this image looks strange, or those numbers don't add up, or they're just adding critiques that, you know, doesn't make the paper wrong, but it might suggest that someone should do a new set of experiments, or, you know, move the research in a particular direction. And it allows people, as you mentioned, to crowdsource the reviews of papers so that everyone can look at them. You know, they're all online. And a lot of this is finding some really important stuff in the literature. And we're actually, you know, in the middle of taking a look at just how many corrections and retractions have happened because of PubPeer and some other similar sites.
So PubPeer's founders are scientists who think science has gone pretty far off the rails. So on their website, PubPeer.com, they write, quote, "The climate of distorted incentives has been exploited by some scientists to build very successful careers upon fabricated data, landing great jobs, publishing apparently high-impact research in top journals, and obtaining extensive funding," end quote. That kind of reminds me of insider trading on Wall Street. Is there something similar happening in science, a very skillful and conscious evasion of the rules?
It's important, and I'm glad you mentioned incentives, because, you know, economists like to say there are no bad people, they're just bad incentives. And if you look at the way scientists are incentivized and the way that they get funded and what they're rewarded for, it's all based on papers. I mean, everything. It's whether you get a grant, whether you get tenure, whether you get promoted, whether you get prizes. And it's all, you've got to be in the high-impact journals, you know, these top journals that everybody reads and everybody cites. And so, you know, what you see is a real warping of what people do. They do whatever they need to do to get funding, and you can, unfortunately, kind of understand that. But it also gives rise to, you know, people who are less scrupulous, or at least it gives people an option. And, you know, whereas most scientists just work hard and they try and do the right thing and, you know, they make some progress, maybe not as much as they'd like, but they make some progress, they report it, there are some, a small percentage of people who will do the wrong thing, who will cut corners and maybe even make things up. That's really, you know, some of what we've seen now. So, you know, and the question is, what is science doing to prevent that? What are people up in arms about it? You know, one of the things we hear a lot when we talk to people about papers that have been retracted is they say, oh yeah, you know, everyone knew that paper was, you know, really problematic, but nobody wanted to say anything because, you know, it's like the thin blue line, or, you know, omerta. It's kind of this, you know, let's not rat anybody out. And that's the problem. That's why PubPeer.com is so important, because it allows people to anonymously comment and people are paying attention to it.
Mm-hmm. Is science seeing kind of a revolt of the junior officers in an effort to unseat the generals and field marshals? There's PubPeer, which empowers the rank and file, and John Ioannidis is not a junior officer, but he's proposed reforms which would give academic rank no value, for instance, and make investigators loath to, quote, become powerful, unquote.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's an interesting metaphor. You know, I'm no sociologist, but one of the things that has sort of become clear to me over time is that, you know, in terms of fans of PubPeer and Attraction Watch and some other similar efforts out there, they are the junior folks, and they're people who, you know, might be postdocs, they might be graduate students, sort of lower rungs on the ladder. They might be junior faculty as well, but as they get more senior, it seems like we have some critics, although still most people think highly of us, but it's more muted. They're used to the system the way it is. So on the one hand, I think the groundswell is coming from the junior, you know, sort of the lower ranks, if you will. But there's definitely enough support in the senior, you know, in the senior faculty and in senior positions that we're starting to see a little bit of movement. And, you know, I would love to see if things didn't have to be anonymous anymore and people could just speak freely, and that would be a wonderful, transparent thing. But I also know that the risks that any junior person takes, or even some senior people take, when they go out on a limb and criticize other people, and that's what we'd like to see change.
Going back to my insider trading analogy, does science have a regulatory agency like the investment world has the Securities and Exchange Commission?
So here in the U.S., science does have something akin to the SEC. It's called the Office of Research Integrity, it's the ORI, and that's part of the, it's really part of the Health and Human Services, which, you know, is where the NIH, I'm sorry to be using all these acronyms, but the National Institutes of Health, which, you know, has a 30-something billion-dollar budget for research. So there's that. There's also the National Science Foundation, which tends to do more sort of physical sciences and things. They have an Office of Inspector General, like many federal agencies do, that operates in a similar, although somewhat different way. So there are those regulatory agencies, and they are a step forward. They, you know, the ORI is about 30 years old now, and they were a step forward because there didn't used to be anything. But they don't have the same kind of power that the SEC does, you know. And the SEC is also much more likely to refer cases to the Department of Justice than the Office of Research Integrity is. So that's why this case that we wrote about over the summer, Dong Tiu Han, it's very unusual that someone's actually facing criminal charges. And so, you know, there isn't really, it's not as strong as something like the SEC or, for that matter, you know, Federal Election Commission actually has the same sort of power there. It's somewhere along the line, and it's actually more power than a lot of agencies in other countries have to do the same sort of work and regulation and oversight. But one of the problems is that the ORI can only supervise. By statute, they can only supervise an institutional investigation. Now, an institutional investigation, even if people are as thorough as possible, there's inherently a bias there. It doesn't look good for an institution when someone commits fraud. So they have a bias against finding, you know, that someone did something wrong. And sometimes the ORI has to come back and say, you know, we need a more rigorous investigation, that wasn't strong enough. And so that'll happen. But there is something in place, but it could definitely be much stronger.
Why haven't science journalists provided a check on scientific fraud?
I think some science journalists have provided a check. But in general, science journalism and health journalism as well, they've been sort of socialized to report on findings. And when you're trying to report on, you know, the journal study of the day or the week, you don't always have time. You know, you're in that hamster wheel. You don't always have time to go back and look what actually happened. You know, journalists can always go out and talk to whoever they want, but a lot of scientists won't talk to reporters until their work is published because the journals have made it clear that publicity will harm their chances of getting published. So it's this kind of strange ecosystem. It's, again, the incentives are pretty screwed up. And so it's a difficult one to break, but I'm seeing a lot of really good work being done. And I like to think that, you know, Retraction Watch and others are contributing to that and really helping reporters understand, you know, what's actually happening in science and what's happening with fraud and misconduct and lack of reproducibility.
So I gave you this question in advance to chew on, but I was struck that 60 sports journalists polled by the Associated Press voted Mississippi State number one in October, but the same 60 experts completely left out Mississippi State from the preseason rankings. Does science journalism ever behave in similar ways?
Yeah, you know, actually, science journalism behaves in a lot of ways like that, and it happens a lot. You know, I think my version of that is the very famous scene from Casablanca that I'm sure you remember, which is, you know, they come and raid the club, and the head of police says, "I'm shocked, shocked, shocked to find out there's gambling going on here." And the guy running, I think it was the craps table, runs up to him and says, "You're winning, sir," right? So there's this notion that, well, we're just sort of going along and doing our thing, and because it behooves us, because it sort of benefits us to, you know, forget that there's some sort of a little bit of a seamy underbelly, or things aren't going exactly the way our headlines said they would, we kind of forget about that. And then we act shocked when there's a big scandal. The trust of journalists by the American public is, I think, basically as low right now as of politicians. And so, you know, if you want trust back, you got to have a good track record. And I think the way to do that is to be transparent, correct your mistakes, and be nuanced, as opposed to just kind of, you know, make a really bold statement all the time that turns out to be wrong.
Are you optimistic about the future of peer-reviewed science?
I'm actually a pretty optimistic guy. I think you kind of have to be to do anything sort of effectively in this world. You have to believe that not so much that things are great and they don't need to change. I think that's a sort of weak kind of optimism, superficial kind of optimism. But that if you shine light, as Louis Brandeis suggested we do, you know, sunlight being the best disinfectant, if you shine light on problems, people will act. People will act in the right way, and they will try and clean things up as best they can. And again, I'm already seeing some evidence. You know, Adam and I are both seeing evidence that retraction notices are more clear, they're more transparent. Not all of them, but a lot of them are. People are paying more attention to fraud. People are, you know, funding research into fraud and funding research into reproducibility issues. Those are all good signs. And that suggests to me that if we continue this and if PubPeer.com thrives, which we really hope it will, other sites and other initiatives, things will move in the right direction. They already are.
Ivan, thank you very much for being on the show.
Oh, thank you, Rob, so much. It was a pleasure speaking to you.
I've been speaking with Ivan Oransky, co-founder of Retraction Watch. I'm Robert Fortner, and you're listening to Digital Divide on KBOO Portland.
And in our last interview, we'll hear a pre-recorded talk with Tom Schroeder and myself. He is the author of the controversial book Acid Test, LSD, Ecstasy, and the Power to Heal. You're listening to The Digital Divide on KBOO Portland. Tom Schroeder is the author of Acid Test, LSD, Ecstasy, and the Power to Heal. Tom Schroeder is an award-winning journalist, New York Times best-selling author, and former editor for The Washington Post magazine and Miami Herald. He has edited numerous magazines and books, which have gone on to win Pulitzer Prizes. His latest book is Acid Test, LSD, Ecstasy, and the Power to Heal, which looks at the history of psychedelic substances and at the current therapeutic uses and FDA-approved trials. Those trials, which include therapeutic treatments using LSD for people facing terminal illness, psilocybin for smoking cessation, and in particular, MDMA or ecstasy for the treatment of PTSD. Welcome to The Digital Divide, Tom Schroeder.
Well, thank you. It's a pleasure.
When I tell people that there are FDA-approved research studies going on with MDMA, psilocybin, and, well, I don't think there are... Are there FDA-approved LSD trials in the U.S.?
Yes, there actually just one recently.
Right. So when I tell people that, and that they're happening at well-known teaching hospitals like Johns Hopkins, they themselves are mind-blown.
Well, it wasn't easy. And what most people don't know is that after Albert Hofmann discovered LSD in the 40s, and for Sandoz Pharmaceutical Company, and they sent it around the world to academics and researchers around the world, people thought that they had found the most important psychiatric drug in history. And for a period of about 15 to 20 years, it was used among thousands of patients to treat all manner of psychiatric ailments with great success. And it only got, and then it got shut down and came ground to a halt when psychedelics sort of found their way onto the street and became associated with the counterculture movement. And you know, Nixon famously called Tim Leary, who was a researcher turned proselytizer for LSD, he called him the most dangerous man in America, which, you know, which was ludicrous in any factual sense. But it did represent the fear of the mainstream culture about psychedelics. And so they made it illegal. They put it on Schedule One, the same as heroin. And they really clamped down on it with tremendous energy. And as one researcher said, it was almost as if LSD had been undiscovered, because research just ended. You know, anybody who even tried, their career was in jeopardy. And ironically, of course, street use only continued to expand. You know, they were afraid of this sort of use, but the authorities found this to be incredibly unsettling, way beyond even the damage that it did. And it did do some damage as a street drug, but it was way exaggerated, and it was nowhere near as bad as a lot of other drugs of abuse in terms of its dangers. And yet they treated it as if it was the most dangerous drug there was. And that stigma prevented any further research for, you know, 30 years.
What was so dangerous or threatening about, you know, revealing what's behind the curtain? Do these drugs in some way, did they threaten organized religion? Did they threaten, like, fundamental concepts that would alter culture and society if we were to delve deeper?
Well, I think that was sort of the knee-jerk reaction of some people, because, you know, the Western culture is based on this very sort of strict rationalist view, and the psychedelic experience of the world sort of questions that. You begin to question, this idea that basically the world is made up of objects that interact with each other according to fixed rules. And when the psychedelic experience suggests that there might be more to the world than that.
Right. So, what's so dangerous about the ideas of everything being connected and everything being part of a whole? Because I think that's a common experience that people have on psychotropic substances.
Yeah, I know. But, somehow it all got connected up to, at the moment in the 60s when this happened, there was this countercultural movement going on. Of people questioning the authorities.
You know who I blame?
Who do you blame?
Art Linkletter.
Oh, because of, yes. Well, the idea was that he said that his daughter committed suicide because she was on LSD. And in fact, there was danger for people taking psychedelics. They haven't been screened. They're doing it in a completely uncontrolled environment, perhaps and under unsafe circumstances, and they have, you know, nobody there to guide them if they get into a difficult psychological situation. And when you're buying drugs on the street, you don't know what they are. But the idea that was broadcast was that people were going insane, you know, taking LSD, instantly going insane, or like running around raping or killing people. You know, the whole Jeffrey McDonald, he killed his wife and kids. He sensed that the way he could make an alibi was to create a story, and that's where all these headlines that said his family was killed by hippies who were chanting, acid is groovy, and people bought that. You know, and that just was it was really a total fiction. And in fact, when they did studies in the 50s and 60s, when, you know, the clinical use with thousands of patients taking it, you know, the official conclusion of one of these big, you know, how they do this sort of mega study review of all the studies that have been done, and the conclusion was that for how powerful the effect was psychoactively, that LSD was an extremely safe drug. And I want to be very clear about this. I'm not saying that it's safe for people to go take indiscriminately without screening and without medical supervision. But in a clinical setting, it was remarkably safe. And what it did, what was so valuable about it, was that it seemed to allow people to, that the issues that were really troubling them just seemed to naturally emerge in these LSD sessions, where they would come into view in various ways, like whether it's through a vision or just through a sudden insight. And life-changing type experience would happen this way. And, you know, the whole history of psychotherapy is how difficult it is for people to change. And here people were having single experiences that, if in fact, changed their behavior for the better permanently.
And that's significant. Well, what I'm curious about is what sparked your interest that led to this book?
Well, it's a long and kind of weird story. I was a student journalist in the 70s at the University of Florida, and I lived in Sarasota, Florida. And so I was home on break, and I noticed that there was this, like, hippie building this fantastic house out of stone and timber and with stained glass in the woods, all, you know, by himself, basically. I mean, he had people helping, but he was the one that was building the house. And I thought that that would be a good story for the student supplement for my newspaper. And so I interviewed him. I wrote the story. And then 10 years later, I was the editor of Tropic Magazine and the Miami Herald. And I saw a story in the Tampa paper saying that there was this sort of perpetual college student who was proclaiming that ecstasy was the sort of silver bullet for psychotherapy. And I looked at this thing, and I saw the name, and I recognized it. It was Rick Doblin, the same guy who I had written the story about 10 years earlier, the hippie in the woods.
And he's a director at MAPS.
Well, now, this is before he was director of MAPS. So I assigned a reporter to go do a cover story on him for the magazine. And we ran that story, and the headline was like a Tim Leary for the 80s. And then, 15 years later, I was the editor of the Washington Post magazine, and I saw a little blurb in the New York Times that Harvard was doing the first psychedelic research since Tim Leary was booted out of there in disgrace. And I looked into who was sponsoring this research, an organization called MAPS, the Multidisciplinary Association for Psychedelic Studies. And the founder and director was Rick Doblin. So I just said, this is ridiculous. I can't believe this. Same guy, hippie in the woods, the Timothy Leary for the 80s, and now he's this sort of, you know, doing respectable work with the higher institutions that have the most credibility of all.
And there's a little bit of serendipity in that story.
Oh, absolutely. There's a lot. And so I called him up, and there's more. I called him up, and he instantly knew who I was. And not only did he know who I was, but he had both those stories, both the one that I wrote in college. And he had them in front of him because he had just had a board meeting, and he wanted to make the point to the board how far his image had come from this sort of Tim Leary wild man character, to this respected sponsor of Harvard research projects. And he had just done that morning. So then I wrote a story about it. And I mean, the reason I was interested in Rick to begin with, back when he was a hippie in the woods, was, and this wasn't really stated in my article, but, you know, he was, the whole reason he was building this house, you know, as his story unfolds in Acid Test, you'll see this, is that he wanted to put what he'd learned from tripping on LSD into real-life principles. And so he thought that to get grounded, to express these values that he had come to believe in through his psychedelic experiences in stone and timber and glass. And I had had some experiences in college mostly it was psilocybin, and in Gainesville you could go and pick these mushrooms out in the cow pastures. And so I had some experiences, and I didn't do it frivolously. I did it because as a means of self-exploration. And I had an experience which had stuck with me, you know, for 30 years after I stopped doing any psychedelics because, you know, I had a family, I had a career, it was still illegal, et cetera. But I had an experience which as the effects of the mushrooms began to be felt, I began to feel all these things I was anxious and worried about, you know, from immediate things like about the next week or the next month to long-term things about my life in general. And I just realized all these sort of fear and anxiety that I carried around with me, and I felt the weight of it. And the thing about the psychedelic experience is that sometimes these things that seem sort of ephemeral or abstract in normal consciousness, when in, you know, under psychedelic consciousness, suddenly they become quite vivid and concrete. And so I actually saw all these cares and fears that I had, almost like a boulder weighing me down. And then I realized the way that I was actually holding the boulder to myself. In other words, I was choosing to hold this weight, and that all I had to do was open my arms and the boulder would fall away. And I actually had this vision where I just simply let go of it, and it fell away, and all that anxiety and fear just disappeared in an instant.
You had a profound experience.
And so for the rest of my life, since then, I've known that that was possible. I mean, that, you know, it wasn't like I got sober and I thought, what was I thinking? I got sober and I realized that was a real truth, and it was a truth that I could use in my life. And it's not like it was instantly easy whenever I had these fears or anxieties to just let them go. But by knowing it was possible and by having had that experience of letting my arms go open and feeling that weight fall away, not imagining it fall away, but feeling it, that made me able to have that as a goal and to work on it. And it's like a muscle that you develop. The more you work on it, the easier it is to do it. And that's really been a very important thing in my life. And that's just one example. And the thing is that I wasn't alone. There were lots of people out there having experiences like this, often in college, et cetera. And a lot of them grew up and became scientists. Some of them became scientists because of that experience. And these people who, you know, who just were working in conservative institutions and had become very accomplished and respectable, in the back of their minds, they always thought, you know what, that is something we should not be ignoring. We really should apply. I've learned how to do science. I should be able to apply that to this. And acid test is really about the people who felt that way and who, against unbelievable odds, managed to push that boulder up the hill and to restart research on these issues.
I'm Rabia Yeaman for The Digital Divide. Today I'm talking with Tom Schroeder, the author of Acid Test, LSD, Ecstasy, and The Power to Heal. In the book Acid Test, you do really painstakingly and fascinating detail go through kind of the entire history of the development of LSD. But tell us about the CIA-funded LSD trials and the Ken Kesey connection.
Okay, so here this research is going on in clinics, and they're getting really amazing results, and more and more people are getting interested in it. And LSD in particular, but psychedelic drugs in general, became the most studied psychoactive drugs in history. And so how did it get out on the street? Well, one of the main ways is that the CIA was doing, and the military, not just the CIA, but the U.S. military and the CIA, were doing these really irresponsible things where they would just be dosing people without their knowledge to see what they would do. Or the CIA even ran a brothel out in San Francisco, and as a way of luring people in, and then they would put LSD in their drinks, and they would record what happened. And these people would have no idea what was there. They might be thinking they were going crazy. And the thing about LSD is if you have an expectation, if you have a fear reaction, it builds on itself. So, of course, you're going to be afraid if your perception is changing for no reason that you know of. So that initial fear could cascade, and there was a suicide on one of these people that the CIA dosed on without their knowledge. So anyway, not only were they doing this, but they were also sponsoring all this research at institutions. And they were like loosely monitored, and they were dosing hundreds of people who had these interesting psychedelic experiences, as you can imagine, and not all of them were bad by a long shot. Most of them were probably positive.
You know what happens when you develop things at universities, like the internet? It doesn't stay in the university.
That's exactly right. They started passing it around. Well, Ken Kesey was, there were two people in particular in the Bay Area that got a hold of some of this CIA acid. And one was Ken Kesey, who did research in Menlo Park and had this experience, and he thought, this is fantastic.
He's like, I have to tell Jerry Garcia about this right away.
Right. And he told Jerry Garcia about it. And then there was a guy named Stanley Ousley, who was the grandson of a U.S. senator, and he was a student at Berkeley, and he had a LSD experience, and he found it so profound, and you know, he had that experience of unity with all things, and he thought, this drug is going to bring world peace because people are going to see we're all connected, and that it's counterproductive, foolish, and crazy to pit one person against another since we're all the same. And so he went to the Berkeley Library and spent 3 weeks there with a partner, a woman, that he hooked up with probably both literally and figuratively. And they taught themselves how to make LSD. And they made thousands of hits of LSD and began distributing them around the Bay Area. And it just exploded from there.
Tom, you wrote in Psychology Today, one of the most noteworthy and advanced efforts has been using MDMA-assisted psychotherapy to treat chronic treatment-resistant PTSD. You wrote, in the completed study of 24 subjects, primarily female victims of rape and sexual abuse, all but three of the 24 subjects experienced lasting remission of their symptoms after just a handful of sessions, in which the drug appeared to allow them to examine the roots of their trauma without fear and generate insights that release them from the disorder's vicious cycle of avoidance, rage, and hypervigilance. So the results of the MDMA or ecstasy in the treatment of untreatable PTSD seems conclusive. Can we say that it helps most or is even cured most of the people who've undergone the supervised therapeutic treatment?
Well, when you talk about clinical trials, you can very frequently get results with small numbers of people that don't hold up over thousands of people. So the next phase in this is to start doing large-scale trials with hundreds of subjects, and hopefully that's coming. You know, there is a difference with MDMA than there is with most drugs that are under development, is that MDMA was used as a therapeutic drug successfully from the time that its psychoactive principles were discovered in the 70s until 1985, when it was made illegal. And it was done so with great success. So there really have been thousands of people who have been helped. But, you know, the argument against that is that at that time they weren't using this rigorous sort of clinical research process that the FDA requires, which they are using now. And the early results are certainly incredibly promising. I have no doubt. And let's be honest, the people who are, you know, who have done this research for years have no doubt that it will hold up over large-scale trials. But it hasn't proven that yet, you know, with like double blinds and all this stuff that's supposed to make sure that this is not some kind of artifact of the process or anything like that. But this is real healing going on.
In the book, you tell the story of a Marine who suffered tremendously at the hands of PTSD for an extended period of time, who had contemplated suicide. Tell us a little bit about that man's story.
Well, this is Nicholas Blackston, and he decided he wanted to be a Marine when he was still a kid. He was like 16 or 17, and then he went into the Marines and, you know, he had the experience in Iraq that a lot of combat soldiers had, where they both felt guilty for the the people that they had killed and the damage done. In some cases, Nicholas said that these two 12-year-old kids came walking out of an alley, spraying an AK-47 at him, and he's sitting up there on a turret of a Humvee with a 50-caliber machine gun. And his training is, if somebody's firing at you, you have to take out that threat. So he, you know, blew them into dust, basically. And then a car comes out in the middle of this, and he's thinking, well, is that a car bomb, or is that just somebody who somehow didn't hear this firefight going on? And you're supposed to, like, shoot out the tires and then the grill and then the windshield, and then it's called tires, grill, kill. And, you know, but with a 50-caliber machine gun, when you're, like, you know, in the middle of this life-threatening situation, it's all tires, grill, kill all at once. So here he killed these two kids. He killed this guy who may have been an innocent civilian, but probably not. And so he had all the guilt for that. And he was in constant fear of his life. I mean, his Humvee went over a roadside bomb, and it blew up. And, you know, he was, like, blown, and he had, like, a concussion. He had wounds. He had shrapnel wounds. He was burned. His truck was on fire, and he had to watch his one of his best friends bleed to death right in front of him. So these were the kinds of experiences that you know, even the VA is saying that 20% of all the 2.5 million people who served in Iraq and Afghanistan are coming home with PTSD. That's 500,000 people, and a lot of people, as many as 500,000, according to their estimates, but many people feel that that's even low. And he didn't just contemplate suicide. He stood he sat on his bed with his service revolver pressed to his temple for, like, you know, minutes at a time, just trying to imagine pulling the trigger and getting the whole mess inside his brain out. That's the way he thought of it.
For relief.
Yeah, for relief. And he had no, and he tried all the treatments, and they only made things worse. The only thing that sort of helped at all was smoking pot, but he felt that, you know, that was just sort of dealing with the symptoms, and it wasn't really getting at the core. And he really felt like there was no way out for him. And then he saw that they were doing these trials, and he went to these sessions, and I mean, the longest chapter in the book, sort of the climax of the book, is when he does these MDMA sessions with a wonderful psychiatrist named Michael Midhofer and his wife Annie, who's a nurse and his co-therapist. And, you know, and what the MDMA does is it allows you to deal with charged emotional issues without that fear reaction. And when you have PTSD, it's like this raw wound, and if you get anywhere near the source of the wound, you scream in agony, and so you can't get. You have to get to the wound in order to try to heal it, but you can't get there because you're clenched tight. And what the MDMA seems to do is it lets people, they feel protected, you know, almost like spiritually protected, like they really believe that everything's going to be okay, And it doesn't make everything okay, but it allows them to go back to the things that they're so frightened of, and that that is lodged in their memory and won't let them rest, won't give them any peace, you know, make them explode in rage, make them have hallucinations and bad dreams, and they get to the roots of those things, and they can pick them up and inspect them. And one vet who had this treatment said it was like watching these bubbles emerge, these bubbles of, like, oh, that's something I'm anxious about. And then they watch them emerge, and then they say, well, that's no big deal, and they just pop and disappear.
I've heard it described, I don't have personal experience with MDMA, but I've in relationship to the PTSD treatments, I've heard it described as allowing the individual to kind of get to the source of compassion, where they can have compassion and forgiveness for themselves and for the perpetrators that may have caused or contributed to the PTSD.
That's exactly right. And that's exactly, you know, what's happening in these sessions. You know, and also they're realizing they're being able to see themselves in their circumstances. As one person said, it was almost like they rose above their life, and they felt like they were on this battlefield, and there was no way out. Well, they rose above the life, and it allowed them to see the battlefield as if it were a map, and to see that there were paths out of there, and to understand that, yes, they could get out, and all they needed to do was to follow these paths out of this battlefield. And, you know, it doesn't mean that there isn't hard work after these sessions. You know, you have to deal with things that you've been suppressing for years in some cases.
Right. It's not like an instant magical fix, but at least it allows them to experience relief from the
symptoms. Yeah, they say, well, I kind of see the path out, and all I have to do is follow it, and it gives them confidence that they can follow it. And, of course, in some cases, there is huge instant relief, and followed by, you know, just a series of working it through. You know, some of these people have issues come up. You know, one of the things that happens in the book is that after his treatment, Nick is fine for a couple of years, and then there's this horrific accident right outside his front door with, you know, two cars hit head-on at high speed, people, bodies scattered around the road. So this gave him, you know, this sort of brought back his symptoms for a time, but what he learned in the therapy allowed him to, you know, sort of to push that back and to get back to feeling good again.
That's really exciting. So do you think the Department of Defense will eventually see the value of the success of the use of MDMA for veterans?
That's the most frustrating thing about this, is that right now, at the current rate, with all the success they're having, it's going to take at least a decade, maybe more, before this is available to a wide group of people as a prescription therapy. I mean, the drug will never be a prescription drug in the sense that you go to the pharmacy and you get it in a little package and take it home with you. But it will be more that your doctor can prescribe this therapy for you, and you go into a clinic and you have this therapy in the secure environment with medical supervision. But that is a minimum of 10 years away, and at the current rate, I really don't believe it, because everything takes three times as long as everybody thinks it's going
to
take.
At least we have something to look forward to, that in the future, the powers that be may come to their senses, or at least maybe the people who are suffering will demand they do.
Well, I certainly hope so.
I do too. I'm Rabia Yemen, and I am talking with Tom Schroeder, the author of Acid Test, LSD, Ecstasy, and the Power to Heal. Tom, where can people find more information about you?
Oh, well, I have a website called tomschroeder.com. I'm also on Twitter at Tom Schroeder, and they can look at, and all the news about Acid Test is on Facebook, on the Acid Test page on Facebook. So if you search for Acid Test on Facebook, you'll find that page.
Thank you, Tom. I hope that we talk again sometime.
Okay, me too. Bye.
And thanks so much for tuning in today to The Digital Divide. Tune in every second Friday of the month at 11 a.m. for the latest stories and information on our digital world. Coming up next, moving on, I think we've got some noon headlines. You're listening to KBOO Portland.
This day, this time, this land, it's all mine. This calling bell, this forge bell, this dark bell, this the knife bell. In the deep wood, this, there I stood, a child so fair. This, on a sudden square, this. down the dirty stairs to see the table set with golden chairs.
You're listening to KBOO Portland. I'm Don Jacobson. Moving on, we'll be here right after the news headlines.
And now for the KBOO news at noon for Friday, November 14th, 2014. A dozen Walmart workers were arrested in Los Angeles last night for blocking a street to protest their working conditions. The street blockade followed another action earlier on Thursday in which workers staged the first ever sit-down strike at a Walmart store. Over the last year, Walmart workers have pressured Walmart to change its pregnancy policy, provide access for more hours, and to raise the wages for minimum wage workers. Walmart has retaliated against workers demanding better wages and working conditions. More information on upcoming actions can be found at the website BlackFridayProtests.com or on Twitter under the hashtag ChangeWalmart. In national news, the GOP-led House of Representatives approved construction of the controversial Keystone XL pipeline this morning. The Keystone debate has become a central focus in the Louisiana Senate runoff election, which is set for December 6th. Republican Representative Bill Cassidy sponsored the House bill and is favored to overthrow incumbent Democratic Senator Mary Landrieu in the December 6th election. Landrieu co-sponsored the Senate bill and generated the renewed drive for the pipeline approval, despite opposition from most Democrats. The Senate is set to vote on Tuesday on the bill, which will then move to President Obama if it achieves 60 votes. Environmental groups are pressuring the president to veto the pipeline's construction. That's all for the KBOO News at noon for Friday, November 14th, 2014. Tune in every weekday at 5 for more local, national, and international news produced by volunteers and reporters in our Portland studios. For KBOO News, I'm Jenka Soderberg.
KBOO Portland. This KBOO